Well met, and welcome to episode 99, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 12th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast we continue our three-month-long discussion of Hamlet with the first half of our video review overview and report from north of the border, the U.S. border. With every play, I like to take a look at the various video versions out there, but with Hamlet, there are a boatload, too many for one podcast, thus part one of a two-part video review. The earliest version I could find was the 1948 Olivier version. Well, that'll come next time. First up this time around, we'll jump to 1964, when Richard Burton played Hamlet for 4 months, which at 137 performances became the longest-running Hamlet on Broadway. Burton, who was nearly 40 at the time, was a huge star already, and his recent wedding with Elizabeth Taylor was one of the reasons behind the long run. Three performances near the end of the run were captured on film and edited together to create a whole that was released for a cinema audience later in 1964, where it did not do nearly as well. Burton has that incredible voice and is wonderfully virile at times, seemingly ill at ease in his own skin at others. It's a solid performance, comic and mercurial and melancholic, yet not earth-shattering. On the other hand, Hume Cronyn as Polonius is simply awesome, comic, and tightly wound to the point of bumbling. His is less of the blowhard Polonius as the well-meaning, just not well-doing variety. The ghost is voiced by the production's director, John Gielgud, and his voice is as miraculous as Burton's. Alas, we never see the ghost, as Gielgud the director chose to make Gielgud the ghost a shadow thrown on the upstage wall. And about that stage, the production takes on a rehearsal-style setting and costuming, with only the play within a play in period costumes. Some of this stemmed from Burton's not wanting to do the play in period dress. We really don't miss the frills of stage dressing or costumes, though it was a little incongruous when Osric appears late in the play with an old-school hat. As it was filmed before the live audience, there aren't many camera angles or movements, and no tight close-ups. It's simply a black-and-white document of the production, which gives us a pretty good sense of what it was like 50 years ago. Claudius, as played by Alfred Drake, is charming but not really villainous. Linda Marsh as Ophelia is often stiff, at times overwrought, and many of her scenes have the feel of an acting exercise rather than a full performance. One interesting note to her performance. She comes into the mad flower scene with flowers, then consciously drops them to the floor before handing out the now invisible flowers to the other characters on stage. It's interesting, though I'm not sure what the point was or if it worked that well. There's very little Oedipal slant to this Hamlet, which I find interesting since the production's Gertrude, Eileen Hurley, had also played that role in the Laurence Olivier film of 1948, where there was quite a bit of Oedipal shaking taking place. The last scene has a couple of points of interest. Laertes cuts Hamlet's arm when the Dane's back is turned, so he walks over to Laertes, snatches the sword from him. They're not switched or exchanged during the fight, and when the duel resumes, Hamlet strikes Laertes with a stabbing blow to the side, which would explain his quicker death. Hamlet doesn't use the sword on Claudius, just forces him to drink the poisoned wine. Claudius dies on the throne, and while Hamlet pushes the king's dead body from the seat of power, he never sits on it himself, dying and falling into Horatio's arms. It's his friend who then places the dead Dane on the throne. There is no discussion of pirates or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's orders or execution, so that felt a little shortchanged. It's not a bad production by any stretch, it's just not transcendental. And because of that, I've got to end this review with a piece of backstory that's more interesting than the production itself. According to theatrical legend, this production came about because of a bet between Burton and Peter O'Toole when they were working on the film Beckett. They decided each to do Hamlet, one in London, the other in New York, one directed by Olivier, the other by Gielgud, based on a coin flip. Burton got Broadway and Gielgud, and the rest is, if not history, at least really cool myth. And regardless of the truth, this version is worth watching, if you can find it on DVD, as it is currently unavailable for streaming. There is another 1964 version, a Soviet version, I tried to watch this last week, but I just didn't have enough time to give it the attention it needed, as it is in Russian with subtitles, and I couldn't just listen to it and look up occasionally. Maybe I'll get around to it. Maybe I won't. Regardless, flash forward 16 years. At the beginning of 1980, the BBC, as part of its collected works series, filmed Hamlet to be the final production of its second of seven seasons. The director, Rodney Bennett, had originally wanted to film the play on location, but during the first season, the decision had been made to make the entire series studio-based, and Bennett used that restriction as the rationale to stylize the production, setting it on a single empty plane. The production starred a then 42-year-old Derek Jacobi as Hamlet, who audiences, and we, saw earlier in the series as Richard II, with Claire Bloom as Gertrude, a four-play veteran of the series, and Patrick Stewart as Claudius. Of course, old Captain Picard is actually 2 years younger than Jacobi, which makes for some very interesting subtext. Even at 3 hours long, it never feels long, nor does it feel rushed in the second half, when some productions are trying desperately to push the pace to skip over that princeless fourth act and get to the end of the play. And while that assured pace helped make this my favorite of the versions I've watched thus far, it's the performance of Jacobi that really stands out. He is an angry, bitter prince at the start of the play. It's interesting that while he's often described as the melancholy Dane, Jacobi's does not shy away from the other related humor. While melancholy has been seen to be caused by an overabundance of black bile, Jacobi seems to see yellow bile playing just as big a role for Hamlet, thus making him choleric as well, on top of the melancholy. Before he even speaks a line, we see him giving Claudius the sarcastic slow clap in the play's second scene. But this anger isn't off-putting, especially when we get to the soliloquies. We don't get voiceovers or tight close-ups staring straight into the camera. Instead, Hamlet begins, then notices us and gives us his commentary. Conversational, almost conspiratorial. In fact, it's almost as if we are the only one he trusts. His interrogation of the sentries and Horatio is just as suspicious and bordering on paranoid as his questioning of Polonius, Ophelia, or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. But even as he grills them, it's not like he doesn't know who they are. Like every good politician or future king, he knows everyone by name. This Hamlet is emotionally torn up by the ghost. You have to wonder if there isn't a bit of actual madness in him. He's definitely antic, just maybe a little too antic to be faking it. He's punny, quick, mercurial to everyone on stage and to us as well. His post-player soliloquy sounds almost like an overdone speech by the players he's just talked to. Just brilliant, especially when it almost seems like he's hoping that the ghost is evil. He's suspicious, and when those suspicions are confirmed, he's prone to violence. And with Ophelia and Gertrude, there is a sexual tinge to it, grabbing at Ophelia's crotch at nunnery and dry-humping his mother at incestuous bed. Not Oedipal, mind you, but punishingly patriarchal. This version is filled with great touches. Hamlet looking around for listeners before launching into the to-be-or-not-to-be speech. His applying makeup to the actors. The first tough guy pirate messenger I've seen in any of the productions. The performances are top-notch across the board, with an exceptionally good Eric Porter as Polonius. And yes, as a Doctor Who fan, I did note series regular Lala Ward as Ophelia, and I've got to wonder what Whovians thought of her at the time, since she was on the show at that time. I've watched about half the productions now, and so far, this is the one to get. It's available on DVD, but alas, at this point in time, not for streaming. There were three versions that came out in the 1990s. Kevin Kline and Mel Gibson, both in 1990 itself, and Kenneth Branagh's no-cut, all-inclusive, four-hour version from 96. And those three will be in part two of our review. Which brings us to the 21st century. In 2000, Ethan Hawke starred in a modern dress version, set in the business world with Denmark being a corporation, directed by Michael Almereyda. With a running time of less than 2 hours, it obviously has a heavily edited text. And it begins with video footage of Hamlet with a soliloquy as voiceover. So not only is it heavily cut, but the pieces are then shuffled around. There are some very good actors involved with this. Bill Murray does a fine job, in my opinion, and some do disagree, as Polonius. Sam Shepard is solid, no pun intended, as the ghost, who makes more appearances in this film than in the play. And Kyle MacLachlan is a fine Claudius, but it is Liev Schreiber who owns this film as Laertes. The women fare less better. Diane Vanora as Gertrude is serviceable, but Julia Stiles, an actress who I have loved in other films, just doesn't work for me. Glassy-eyed and never truly present. There's also an appearance by a pre-Deadwood Paula Malcolmson as Marcella, but other than the Deadwood reference, there's really no reason to talk about it. Stiles and Vanora are Redgrave and Mirren, however, compared to Ethan Hawke. At no point in the film did I feel that he fully knew what he was saying. It's like watching a dog speak Russian. His lips move, sounds come out, but it doesn't work or make any sense. There are just so many things wrong with this film that it would seem like piling on to list them. So let me list some of the good things. The use of security cam footage in Hotel Elsinore works in the modern setting. Hamlet being a hipster filmmaker with his knit cap is a nice touch, since it allows him to create his own film as the Mousetrap and allows a whole bunch of player-centric dialogue to be cut. Having Ophelia wear a wire when with Hamlet works, as does Gertrude's silent but visible whisper to Hamlet after she has swallowed the poison. The sudden use of a pulled handgun in the final fencing match is exciting and surprising. But that's about it. Other things simply don't work. Cutaways to jets flying in the air, the use of a newsman at the end, and the to-be-or-not-to-be soliloquy in a Blockbuster video store. And speaking of Blockbuster, this film has not aged well in the last 15 years. Huge laptop computers, floppy disks, and fax machines don't work now. This is simply not a good film. It's pretty to look at, but completely empty. Kind of how I feel about its star. In that same year, 2000, Campbell Scott adapted and co-directed with Eric Simonson a much better television production for Hallmark Entertainment. It's unclear as to the actual setting. It felt to me Edwardian, but I've seen it listed as post-American Civil War. I'm guessing the American part of the description comes since this is a purely American production with no English accents to be found. The 39-year-old Scott, son of famed actor George C. Scott, also served as the lead character. And while that might make this seem like a vanity project, since Scott is not a huge marquee name, he does a fine job in all three roles. And his is one of the better Hamlets I've watched thus far. As far as any production with soliloquies can be naturalistic, this felt very much so. Some lines are whispered, some even mumbled, and what we lose in vocal clarity, we do gain in seeming realism. And the vast majority of supporting performances are good. Polonius, as played by Roscoe Lee Brown, is not a doddering old fool, but rather a shrewd politician, tougher than usual, as befits that great voice of his. Jamie Sheridan is wonderfully slick as Claudius. We can see why both Gertrude and the court love him, even though that which makes him appealing also makes others a little uncomfortable, as is the case in the court scene in Act 1, Scene 2. Blair Brown makes her Gertrude a little more obviously physically attracted to Claudius, and Linda Gay Hamilton makes for a stoic rather than weepy Ophelia. Scott comes the closest to being actually insane, at least thus far, outmadding Jacoby's Dane. When he sees the ghost, he relives his father's death himself, and he continues to hear the sounds of the ghost's voice in his head throughout the play. And yet, it isn't all in his imagination. The ghost takes from beneath the ground the sword that Horatio and Marcella swear upon. Supporting the he's really mad theme is the fact that Hamlet cuts himself immediately before the to be or not to be soliloquy, making it more explicitly about suicide than any of the versions I've seen thus far. The relationship between Ophelia and Hamlet takes an interesting dimension in this version as well. She kisses him, full on the mouth, even after being told to get to a nunnery. The passion is returned, and by this passion, I cannot believe that this is a first kiss. Their relationship must have been physicalized before. And because of this, when Hamlet realizes he's being watched and overheard, the viciousness of his response is quite painful for Ophelia to watch, as are his callous remarks about Polonius's body, which she sees. The player portion is well done, with Hamlet as the worst director ever, even as he gives some of the greatest advice ever. He keeps interrupting the actors, frustrating them. But if Hamlet is a crappy director, he's a damned good playwright, as the uncomfortable looks on faces of the audience leading up to the murder scene can attest. Not only does Claudius see what the audience is seeing, he also sees the ghost of his brother momentarily in the play as well. That would explain why the same actor plays both the ghost and the player king. Of course, this plot addition is a bit of a cheat. Claudius doesn't deliver his confessional soliloquy for another scene. But one aspect I liked about this production is the strength of its characters. I've already talked a little about Ophelia's stoicism, but she's not alone. Gertrude is stronger here as well, even slapping Hamlet at the beginning of the closet scene. And even after Hamlet stabs through the curtain, the dying Polonius fights back. This is not to say that all is perfect with this film. Even Scott's lead feels a bit off when he returns from England. It's as if he has lost any insanity he might have had before leaving the country. Laertes is far too low-key for my taste, and I miss Gertrude's description of Ophelia's death. And the soundtrack is, well, let's just call it obtrusive and leave it at that. But so much compensates for this, including Ophelia in her first mad scene wearing her father's bloody dinner jacket, Gertrude attempting to clean up Polonius's blood in her chamber, and Hamlet seeing the ghost one last time as he dies. It's not a great Hamlet, but it is a very good one. I've only found it as a streaming rental on Amazon, but try to search it out. And finally, or at least most recently, in 2009, the BBC released a version of the play directed by current Royal Shakespeare Company artistic director Gregory Doran and starring 38-year-old David Tennant as Hamlet and Patrick Stewart as both Claudius and the Ghost. It's a modern dress version, very stylishly done. Some of the nice touches that Doran adds are the use of security cams, not only in the play's opening sequence with the ghost and the guards, but also when Hamlet tears one apart to keep from being watched. Of course, not all the modern touches work. Hamlet's t-shirts are a bit too hipster for me, and the modern setting doesn't exactly scream out for a fencing match. Tennant is solid, manic, but not really mad. On the other hand, Mariah Gale's Ophelia? Oh, she's cray-cray, but wonderfully so. Stewart is much better as Claudius than as the ghost, which is pretty much a thankless role anyway, and Oliver Ford Davies stands out as Polonius. The good. Gertrude knowing, or at least suspecting, that the goblet is poisoned even before drinking it. Not so good. The overly pushed pace in the last two acts, as it shortchanges both the Fortinbras and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern subplot. In doing so, it becomes much more a personal story and not one of a prince of Denmark. It's not horrible, but it certainly isn't great. Meh is about what sums it up. Check it out if you have time or a completist. It is available only on DVD. Last week I went to my first Shakespeare Association of America conference up in Vancouver, British Columbia. The Shakespeare Association of America is a non-profit professional organization for the advanced academic study of Shakespeare's plays and poems and the many roles he's played in world culture. Founded in 1972, it holds an annual conference where members meet to exchange ideas. Sessions at the meeting also include panel presentations, roundtable discussions, and the like. The sessions and workshops are intended for postdoctoral scholars and for graduate students at the dissertation stage, but members can also attend the conference as auditors. I was one of those auditors. For me, my first SAA conference was great right up till the end. On the night of pre-registration, things got off to a great start with a performing workshop called Embodying Shakespeare's Text, presented by the faculty members and actors from Langara College's Studio 58. Absolutely fascinating, watching the faculty members work the students through their monologues. It wasn't indicative of what I'd be seeing and hearing the rest of the conference, but it was a great way to start. On that first day, I attended two sessions, Playhouses and Early Modern Playing Venues, and Broadcast Your Shakespeare. Both started slowly, so much so that I had to wonder if I had picked the wrong session to go to, since there's at least 10 going on at any given time, but each finished strong. The sessions, 2 hours long, center around a topic, with the members of the session discussing the papers that they had presented. Other attendees, the auditors, can sit around the outskirts and listen in while reading the abstracts. The first one had papers that discussed subjects from the Red Bull Theater to modern recreations of theaters to the use of stools on stage for special audience members. Fascinating stuff. No less so because the panel included Dr. Ralph Cohen of the American Shakespeare Center. Yes, I'm a fanboy. I listen to his always interesting podcasts, and damn it, you should too. I then checked out the Digital Salon that showcased some Shakespeare-centric technology projects. Very cool stuff here. And it gives me hope that an idea that I've been harboring for years still has a place. I just need to find some time to put it all together. The afternoon was spent at the Broadcaster Shakespeare session that discussed, among other subjects, the use of phonograph records to teach Shakespeare in the early 20th century, Orson Welles, zombie Shakespeare, Juliet on Tumblr, relating Shakespeare to video games, and the hipster's role in conserving Shakespeare on YouTube. I really liked this session by the end. Then I hit the danger zone, the book exhibit room. 3 books and 40 bucks later, I think I escaped pretty much unscathed. I headed back to my hotel room, exhausted. The second day started with a single audience plenary session. It was, in a sense, like the other seminars, only this one had just 3 experts, all heavy hitters, and the entire conference were the auditors. The plenary session was titled Shakespeare and the Cut, with Bruce Smith from USC, Michael Dobson from the Shakespeare Institute and the University of Birmingham, and Thomas Cartelli from Muhlenberg College. Unlike the first day's sessions, there was no slow start here. Smith spoke on rethinking cuts in an age of distraction, arguing that there are 3 kinds of cuts: to change perception, to employ different technologies, and for aesthetic purposes. And even the concept of an uncut version is fallacious at best, he argues, disingenuous at worst. It's an illusion. He closed with the concept of a continuum of edited texts, from seamed and holistic at one end to tattered and deconstructed at the other. Then Dobson came in and stole the show. I knew of Dobson from the Hamlet-centric MOOC, massive open online course from the RSC, the Shakespeare Institute, and the University of Birmingham, which I had taken a few months back. And he didn't disappoint, discussing how Hamlet has always been seen as long, with some hilarious criticism from Francis Gentleman, whose writing convinced actor-director David Garrick to cut the rubbish of the gravedigger scene in Act 5. He also answered the question, what is Hamlet now, with seemingly contradictory answers. It's cut-proof, and it's the sum of all previous cut Hamlets. And as he ended it, he said, and the rest is... Lastly, Cartelli bemoaned having to follow Dobson, but he was more than up for the challenge, arguing that the uncut fidelity model often results in a lifeless result. If the cuts concentrate and clarify, then the result is a distillation, a stronger production. He then talked a little bit about some radical versions of Midsummer, Hamlet, and Twelfth Night, including an example of algorithmic theater, where a computer generates the text after an algorithmic distillation. It's great in theory, but I wonder what it would be like as an audience member. I actually kind of shudder to think about it. Because I had such a great time 2 nights earlier at the Embodying Shakespeare's Text workshop, I attended the late afternoon session led by another Langara College professor, this one called Voice Intensive Workshop, Elemental Shakespeare. The description had given me the impression that the session would be on both elements and the humors, something that is just simply fascinating to me. Unfortunately, it was only on the elements and not that great for me. It was the first session of the entire conference for which I wish I had chosen differently. In the morning of the third and final day, I participated in the 3-hour teacher workshop, Unpacking Shakespeare's Toolbox, Wordcraft and Stagecraft for the Classroom. Oh man, this was the best thing in the entire conference as far as I'm concerned, even better than the previous day's plenary session. Leading the first half was Bard on the Beach's education director, Mary Hartman, who led us through some wonderful play. And this is the key for our education. As she pointed out, as a playwright, Shakespeare wrote plays for players to perform in play houses. It wasn't until the 18th century that we began to talk about the complete works of Shakespeare. We have lost the sense of play in school. Now, I knew this going in, but having it presented like this was just a complete paradigm shift. Hartman got us up and on our feet and playing, playing with our bodies, our voices, our minds. It was just wonderful. The second half was with the folks from the American Shakespeare Center in Staunton, Virginia. And you know that I'm a big fan of Dr. Ralph Cohen, and he brought with him Sarah Enlow and Cass Morris from the center. And we spent the rest of the morning talking about how to present the words to the students. And there are so many different ways to do this, and I was reminded of a few that I had forgotten about in the long decades since leaving the classroom, like the use of prompt scripts, and learned some new ones, strategies for breaking up the lines and playing, again, playing, with rhetorical devices. I cannot wait to share these activities. Needless to say, I'm going to be adding to and changing future presentations. I know two short paragraphs can't possibly show how much I loved this session or how fun, cool, and enlightening it was, but trust me, it was. Now, the reason why it's only two short paragraphs is that in the second half of the workshop, I could feel something coming on. Chills, body aches. Now, I had felt chills and body aches the day before, but powered through it for the most part. Saturday, not so much. In fact, I felt so poorly that I skipped the last two sessions of the day, two that I had circled as being central to my reason for attending the conference. One was how to get published. At least I was able to pick up a handout from that session before I headed back to my hotel room and slept for two straight hours. The other was on Shakespeare in film form. You know how much I absolutely love film. But instead of making that session, I was in bed for the night, foregoing as well the reception and a dance. When I arrived on Wednesday, I wasn't so sure I was going to do either, but now sick on Saturday, it was a definite no. What's a definite yes? Well, attending next year's conference in New Orleans. My goal is to shake off any sense of intellectual inferiority and submit a paper for next year's conference in New Orleans, and then write a paper that's good enough to be selected for a session panel at the 2017 conference in Atlanta. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries the last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including Dear Scansion, thank you, signed Laertes' mother. Hamlet, long-winded. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, the theatrical ripple effects. Hamlet, more theatrical ripple effects. Another happy birthday. Cruel to be kind. Old-timey Hamlet posters. Hamlet, no happy ending like Lear, no fooling. Greetings from Vancouver. The SAA Day 1. Day 2. Day 3. Beauteous or beautified Hamlet. Hamlet, a ghost story. Now on pod directory. And questions re the ghost in Hamlet. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussion of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again in a couple of weeks for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. Been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 12th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.